Thank you, Steve. Thank you, everybody. I know it's been a long day and a long afternoon, so thank you guys for hanging with us. This is an issue that I wanted to moderate because this is an issue that's really close and near and dear to me. There was actually, somebody else held a conference in New York City not so long ago, and they had a marijuana and media panel, but they didn't see fit to put me on it, so I didn't go. But I did think it would be a great choice to have a panel here to discuss the media and the way the media's coverage of marijuana has really evolved. And just to give you a little background, you know, I cut my teeth working on this issue over 20 years ago, and one of the first published op-eds, first byline that I had to my credit was specific to this issue, and it was published in 1993 while I was still in college. And at the time, I remember thinking, this is really easy. You pitch editors on a story, they say yes, you write your story, and they pay you. Little did I know that at that time, that was more anomalous than it was the rule. But fortunately, we've seen a lot of change, a lot of evolution, the way the media handles this issue. So I want to address it sort of from both sides of the issue. As somebody who constantly speaks with the media for the stories that reporters are writing, someone who sometimes critiques the media and the way that their coverage is, and someone who also writes for a number of different media outlets, both online and both in print. So we've got two people on this panel that I'm really glad to have here. One, we have Kristen Gwynn, who is a writer and editor of TheInfluence.org, and she's a former editor at High Times and also at Alternate.org. In fact, she was my editor at Alternate.org, and a fantastic editor she is. Her own writing on drug war issues has appeared in Rolling Stone and Truth Out in The Nation and a number of other high-profile outlets. She holds a journalism degree from NYU, and she probably curses more than I do, so I really appreciate that. We also have Bruce Barka, who's an award-winning author whose work has appeared in numerous prominent publications such as National Geographic, Outside Magazine, and Time Magazine. He's the author of the 2015 book Weed the People, The Future of Legal Marijuana in America, and right now he serves as the deputy editor for Leafly.com, which bills itself as the world's largest cannabis information resource. And I gotta say, working at Normal, I do take a bit of offense to that claim. So we can talk about that later. But right now I do want to talk about the issue of marijuana and the media. And the first question I have is to Bruce. And this stems from something you wrote on your Twitter feed recently. There was a very prominent story that ran the New York Times recently about dabbing. I was interviewed for that story. It was one of the more strained, sort of painful interviews that I've done in some time with that particular reporter. And I did not have a good feeling of how that coverage was going to play out when that story was to run. But when Bruce saw the story ran, he elected to call it on his Twitter feed embarrassing. And he went on to add, if this reporter covered politics or business with this much naivete, she would be laughed out of the room. Now, as a reporter, as a former editor, sort of my question to you is, you know, what made you single out that story for that type of public criticism? And can you walk us through, you know, what's the process regarding that results in a one-sided story like this? I mean, the New York Times, not too long ago, their editorial board opined in favor of legalization. So it's not as if this is a prohibitionist editorial board. So again, why single out that story, and how, working in a newsroom, how do we end up with these sort of one-sided stories from time to time?
Sure, I singled out that story. Is this working?
It's got to switch.
Sorry.
Front.
There we go. Is that better? Okay. I singled out that story for a number of reasons. Number one, it was in the New York Times, which, you know, as you say, has been on a crusade in its op-ed page or its editorial section in the last year and a half or so regarding marijuana laws. So number one, I wondered if that reporter had even been reading her own newspaper. But number two, it's in the New York Times. That's a position of massive power. I have done freelance pieces for the Times over the years, and I know, or at least have experienced, a lot of the fact-checking process that goes into that. I mean, I did a piece once on some mycologists who were looking for new species of mushrooms, and we ended up spending 3 days defining how many species of plants existed that were known to science. And so for this reporter to come out with a story that seemed rooted in the 1980s, it was your classic naive reporter going out, running into some private school kids on Fifth Avenue who were using some sort of cannabis concentrate, and essentially then running to the police and the local DEA agent, who seemed to be her only sources. I mean, I'm amazed she contacted you and didn't quote you in some
clearly
way.
Clearly talked to me after she had talked to those sources.
But it was in the story, essentially, she ran to the police. The police said, we have nothing on record of ever arresting anybody for a cannabis concentrate. And then she went to the local DEA agent, who told her that, well, we're on top of this. We like to you know, let the public know and warn them of any new drugs that are on the market. And the idea that a marijuana concentrate was a new drug on the market, that was the latest incarnation of crack or flocka or whatever you want to you want to call it, was fairly outrageous to me. First, as a reader of the New York Times, the idea that you wouldn't go online and look up these terms, marijuana concentrates, and all the information that's available, you know, on my own website, Leafly, but plenty of other sites as well. But then the whole narrative was the classic 1980s, oh my God, the kids are into some new drug. Nobody knows anything about it. Again, Paul, to your research, nobody knows anything about the long-term effects of this. It was an embarrassing piece of work. And it was a typical of marijuana stories where you can write whatever you want still in the mainstream press. If you had done it in a business section, if you had done it on politics, they would not have allowed it to run. That's why I called it out. And also I called it out because it's the New York Times and every other newspaper, every other media outlet in America looks at the Times, those editors rip those stories and hand it to their reporters and say, localize this.
Okay, so this question is to Kristen. So, you know, you've been a writer about these and other drug-related subjects for a number of different outlets, The Nation, Rolling Stone. You worked as an editor at various outlets. Right now you're working as an editor for TheInfluence.org. You know, what, in your opinion, tends to be missing from mainstream journalism coverage of the marijuana issue or the drug issue overall? How could this coverage be improved? Or what are the sort of stories and angles that you think ought to be prominently covered but generally aren't being prominently covered? What's missing?
I think that generally speaking, what's missing is an appreciation for nuance as well as intersectionality. I think a lot of times when you see coverage of marijuana policy, it's just in terms of, you know, what should people be allowed to go get high and why should I care, and not how marijuana arrests might perpetuate inequality and contribute to a number of different political issues that people care about. Like people had mentioned immigration earlier and access to education. And I think that's a big issue in mainstream coverage of marijuana policy, is failing to understand the different consequences of a marijuana arrest just being on your record, aside from people just saying, oh, you don't deserve to be in jail. Also, I think a big thing that's missing is their ability to kind of objectively take information that might at the surface seem accurate or concerning, like the claim that the THC levels are so much higher now than they had been in the past. That's true, but we also know that people make up for that by using lower quantities and things like that. So I think that to be better, what the mainstream media would need to do is to have a really just a better understanding of the issue and speak to people who are experts on the plants. A lot of times the media relies on like the police and the rehab industry, so people who have a stake in prohibition and a stake in hyping up the dangers of drugs, and that if media were to listen to maybe scientists or even drug users themselves, they might be able to have a better understanding of the issue and how to more accurately and comprehensively cover it.
Okay, so this is a question back to Bruce, and this is something that I give a lot of thought to because I respond to media inquiries daily. And I'm shocked at what I consider to be a lack of institutional memory. A good example is a very prominent health wire. Their stories run in WebMD, and they're picked up across the country. Called me, and they said, we have a study. It's embargoed. The embargo is going to be released in 48 hours, and we want you to comment on it. And I provided them some comments, and they ran the story along with other media outlets, and it was all over the papers for a 24-hour news cycle. The authors of that study, as authors are apt to do in a publish or perish world, basically took the same data and simply shifted the tone and submitted it to another journal, and that journal decided to publish it. So 6 months later, this other journal was essentially recycling the same data, and they put it out with an embargo. And the same news media outlet, 6 months later, said, we've got a study coming out, and it's embargoed, and would you comment on it? And I took one look at it, and I said, this is the same data. You realize you covered this same study when it came out 6 months ago. And I sent them a link to their coverage of the study. Now, it happened to be one reporter for that outlet ran the first story, and this new study was assigned to a separate reporter, and one reporter wasn't familiar with what the other reporter had covered. And this speaks in the most prominent way to what I consider this lack of institutional memory. You see this all the time. Marijuana-related stories are written as if they're written in a bubble. No one else has ever written about marijuana before. No study's ever been done about marijuana before. Study comes out, they says, marijuana is associated with a lowering of IQ points by 8. As if it's the only study that's ever looked at marijuana IQ before. There's actually dozens of studies that have looked at marijuana IQ, but none of them are ever referenced. So when I think about this sort of lack of context and lack of institutional memory, what I've sort of surmised, what may be responsible for this is the idea that most news agencies, most media outlets, they have certain beats. They have their science reporter, they have their health reporter, they have their political reporter, they have their culture reporter. But marijuana news seems to encompass all of these subjects. And so when you were working at Time, for instance, and covering marijuana, where would you categorize those stories? Where were they filed? Were they under politics? Were they under health and lifestyle? Were they under science? And is there a need for what I'd call, say, a marijuana beat? We just have beat reporters who cover these stories, and is it the lack of that sort of those beat reporters, the lack of these stories being filed or categorized the same way, is that what leads to this lack of institutional memory, or are my expectations just way too high?
No, it's true. I mean, when I was writing on this subject for Time, I was a freelancer. I mean, I'd written a book, and some of the pieces I wrote for Time came from the book. So it wasn't my beat, but I was a guy who covered that subject, so they were happy to run pieces from me there. I mean, one of the reasons that, you know, I'm now at Leafly was that, you know, I spent 20 years writing for National Geographic, for Outside, freelance pieces for The Times and elsewhere. And once I wrote Weed the People, I really wanted to continue writing on this subject. And I found it increasingly difficult, which is not what I expected, to place pieces in national magazines. And mostly that was because what I would hear back from editors was, oh, this is a great piece, love the idea, love the characters, but you know what, we ran a piece on pot last year, so we can't touch it really for another year or so. There's still a stigma, there's still a feeling that this subject is déclassé. And right now we have, I mean, besides Kristen Ryan at the Huffington Post, myself, we have Ricardo Baca at the Denver Post, we have Bob Young at the Seattle Times, and thank God for Christopher Ingram at the Washington Post. I mean, seriously, when he goes on vacation, we get nervous because those sorts of stories often go to somebody else's desk who doesn't know anything about the issue. And when Christopher stops covering this topic, I don't think somebody else is going to pick it up. But the thing that is unique about Christopher and a few others is he gives a damn. He actually cares about the issue, the science, the subject, the policy. It's not a one-off story, because when it's a one-off story for a reporter at any mainstream publication, nobody wants to be the pot reporter, right? Because, oh, why do you have an interest in that, Bob? You know, that's still a dynamic that's very much in play.
It's really interesting you say that, going back to that New York Times piece earlier. I got the sense, and I told somebody shortly after this very pained interview, I said, talking to this reporter, I got the sense she drew the short straw.
Yeah.
You know, that this was not a story she wanted to do. She felt it was beneath her.
Right.
But she had to write it, and she was obligated to talk to somebody like me, but none of us wanted to have any part of it.
And right now, for me, my feeling is that leaves this massive playing field open. I mean, there's so many facets to this subject, from the politics and economics to the science and medicine to it, and it's just sitting there waiting for people to write about it.
Sure. Okay, so here's a question for both of you. And now, I know, Kristen, when you were my editor alternate, you did not do this. But anybody in this room that's ever read stories about marijuana knows there seems to be some cardinal rule set in stone somewhere that says if you're publishing a story about marijuana, no matter how serious the story is, you've got to have some sort of pun in the headline. It's just the way it's got to be. And so, again, looking at your experience, and to both of you, because now, obviously, you're an editor, Bruce, at Leafly, what is the story with this need in this day and age to still go with puns in the headlines? I mean, is this strictly done? Is it laziness? Is it just done for clickbait? And really, in my opinion, the real important question of this is, do these puns in the headlines, do they undermine the seriousness of this issue, both to the public who reads those stories and the politicians who may be involved in this narrative, but also to the journalists? Like you were just saying, nobody wants to be the pot one-off journalist. Is part of that because they know no matter how serious a story they write, they're going to have this joke headline above it? So what's going on there?
I mean, I'm not sure. Is it unique to weed headlines, the puns? I feel like it's in journalism, in terms of headlines, a pun. If you can find a pun, people will take a pun, and yes, it's about clicks.
This has always been a copy editor's job, is to come up with a now it's a clicky headline, but it was back in the day, it was just a clever headline. And because marijuana has such a long and deep and rich cultural history, there's a lot of puns to draw upon. And sadly, I do think it does debase the issue to a certain extent. I mean, there's Andrew Sullivan has an interesting argument about how the way in which pot has been treated with silliness and humor has undermined it as a serious issue. And in fact, I mean, that's one of the issues that we have discussions about language and how we treat issues every day at Leafly. And one of the things that we're trying to do and we talk about is trying to find new ways to talk seriously about the fun aspects of marijuana, about the fact that people laugh sometimes when they're, consuming marijuana, and how to do it in a way that is serious and takes that part of the experience, not as a joke.
I think that's important because I do think with the headlines and the puns, I mean, I have a story with a headline on Rolling Stone, I think, that uses the word ganjapreneur. And that was even so corny for me that, I died when I saw it. But I understood it, I understood why it was there, but I did feel like, well, this just makes my story look stupid now because it says ganjapreneur. But I do think that there is room to laugh and to get clicks, so it is about deciding what content is appropriate to be treated, like it's funny or it's not.
Yeah, I mean, and there, I think in a way we're seeing a new generation of headlines where the problem isn't so much the pun, it's the inaccuracy of the headline. I mean, there's a piece in The Guardian, I can't remember if it was today or yesterday, just to profile Jeremy Moberg, as a farmer in Washington State, and the headline was something along the lines of marijuana millionaires reaping, benefits of legalization. Now, have you ever met Jeremy Moberg? Jeremy is not a millionaire. Like, I think he probably, grosses about $900,000 a year from his farm, which, $900,000 gross on a farm does not make you a millionaire. But that's one of the new tropes that headline writers love to put out there. And as a result, so many more people read the headline than the story. The meme gets out there that these folks are cashing in on the marijuana crop in ways maybe that they shouldn't for some reason. I don't know.
the question headline is one that we're seeing a lot with marijuana policy right now, and that's, I think, even worse than the puns, you know, is like, will legalizing weed solve racist marijuana arrest? Like, things when the answer is obvious, pretty much almost always no, and yet the question will be posed in the headline regardless.
Yeah, and I'll just add to this, because Dan, you asked it earlier. You know, one of the worst headlines that's come out in recent memory was CBS and a couple of other outlets ran with it. This notion that said marijuana crashes double, or fatal crashes involving marijuana doubled in Washington State. As you said, most people read the headline. The article itself wasn't that bad. Because it was based on the AAA report, which wasn't that bad, which was accurate reporting. But AAA did not say that marijuana-involved crashes doubled, and the data didn't say that either. A headline editor at CBS decided that ought to be the headline, and unfortunately, that is going to be the narrative in many ways that we are going to have to be up against. Not because the story was poorly published, not because it was based on biased data, but simply because one person editorial board went for what they assumed, I guess, would be a sensational headline. And it has policy implications.
The weird thing on that was less than 2% of these were marijuana only.
Yeah. But, Glennis, we could talk all day about that data, believe me.
They didn't tease alcohol.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm seeing more and more headlines along the lines of the sort of the X failure of legal pot.
Yes, The Atlantic just had another headline.
The Atlantic Monthly piece, where the failure was essentially that the racial disparity was the sticky part of arrests, right? And it's like a legitimate point, but that's not the failure. The Seattle Times said something very similar, where the failure was the fact that the legislators were actually kind of robbing the pot, so to speak, of money coming from taxes for what it was not intended. That was the failure. Anyway,
it's also an issue, I think, when you have people who don't write about the topic, and then it's like they've just discovered that, you know, marijuana is legal, but racism exists in policing, and so they can get away with writing a 5,000-word long-form story about it as if it's breaking news and it's treated that way. But it can be frustrating when it's like everyone who's been on the beat already knows that, and that, like, there are nuanced conversations you can have about how to change that aren't being addressed.
Okay, a couple more questions before we wind down. One, and again, this is to
both of you. Right now, both of you are writing for online alternative news media outlets. Do you think the conventional media takes these sort of outlets seriously? It takes the coverage that you dedicate to marijuana policy or drug policy at something like leafly.com or at The Influence? You know, is it possible, do you foresee a day where sites like yours end up being treated, your stories carry the same weight as stories published in more conventional media outlets, where you break news on those sites and the mainstream media acknowledges that it was these alternative sites that were breaking news? Or are you concerned that the mainstream media is simply going to shrug these sort of sites off and label you with advocacy and not hard news? Where do you see that trend going?
Well, we actually, the Columbia Journalism Review did a story about The Influence that basically asked that same question, saying, you know, is this advocacy or is this journalism, and what would it take to convince people that it's the latter, basically. And I'm not sure that the writer himself came up with an answer, but I think that really what it comes down to is having quality content and being the best. And I don't know if it's a matter of breaking news so much as having the best perspective and the most informed take, because the bigger publications will have more access to breaking news no matter what, but they might have to take other people seriously when it's the, you know, alternative publications whose stories are being passed around and being utilized by professors or people with leverage in, you know, the industry or the academic space or something, and then they might kind of be forced to confront where they've screwed up, especially now just because of the internet and Twitter. It's like if someone does something right that someone else has done wrong, that person is going to hear about it.
Yeah, I mean, the New York Times didn't have to take BuzzFeed seriously until the day they did, and then they took it really, really seriously. I mean, I just hired on at Leafly about 4 months ago. You know, a couple editors came on about the same time, and sort of we have this great big ball of clay that we can make into whatever we want, and we're shooting to make it something like, you know, the Slate of this space, the Jezebel, the 538, something like that. I'm assigning writers who are colleagues of mine who wrote for write for National Geographic and Slate and the New York Times and Harper's, and we're, you know, working to get that sort of journalism, that level of writing onto this site. And hopefully, you know, a year from now, that'll be much more well-known. I can't say that, you know, we're going to force the New York Times to take us seriously, but you know, sites like Leafly and The Influence and others are now starting to be cited or quoted in mainstream media outlets without that defining phrase afterwards. And that we take as a sign of hope and a little sign of respect. I don't know.
Okay. And a final question, again, to both of you. Like I said, I think I sort of cut my teeth on this over 20 years ago, and definitely I felt that there's been a tone or a shift in the conversations that I have when reporters call me now that didn't exist 10, 15 years ago. There's a level of respect that I'm given that certainly wasn't the case many years ago. And particularly, there was a real change after 2012. When reporters started to schedule time for interviews. They just didn't call and expect you to jump. The same sort of talking points and statements I made in the past seemed to carry more weight. There definitely seemed to be a shift that was occurring. We've also seen, as I mentioned earlier, a significant shift in public opinion regarding how the public thinks about marijuana and about the idea of alternative prohibition in general. So it's sort of a chicken and egg question. Do you think that these recent changes in public sentiment that we're seeing with regard to the way the public feels about changing marijuana laws or marijuana legalization overall, do you think they're the result of more accurate reporting by the media, or do you think media coverage is evolving and getting better because the media is responding to the fact that public attitudes about marijuana are shifting?
I think media people would be biased to say that the media has done something to change public opinion, but I think that in this case, it's pretty clear that public opinion has pushed media. I mean, also, you're seeing so many marijuana-specific outlets popping up right now. It's like there's a demand for it that the mainstream media didn't create. If anything, they left a gap for. So.
Yeah, I think except for the media outlets that have always pushed this issue and been out there, like High Times, like The Nation, like Rolling Stone, mainstream media is still far, far behind this issue. I think things changed because of medical marijuana dispensaries, medical marijuana laws, people coming to information on the internet on their own, not through mainstream media. I think the media in general is still far behind and catching up.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think that is? Do you think is some of it age specific? Are the because the editors may be from one time and younger writers may not be? Or why is the mainstream media lagging behind? Is it advertising?
I think partly it's age. I mean, there was a great panel earlier today talking about Congress and the idea that, you know, new members of Congress are younger and are more open to this issue, whereas, you know, the Charles Grassleys of the world, who are the committee chairs, come from a very different generation, and that tends to be the case with editors at these publications. I'm 50 years old, and I'm not the norm. You know, I would not have wanted to handle one of these stories 4 or 5 years ago, and it took a huge change in my state and myself to get to where I am today, but that's not usually the case in other papers.
Also, the issue of objectivity, I think when you're talking to older editors, they'll want to say, you know, clearly, like, find some middle ground to straddle and things like that. And when you're talking about, like, marijuana legalization and whether that not you should do that, it becomes bad reporting. So it's probably easier to just not do it.
Mm-hmm. We've got time for maybe 5 minutes worth of questions. If people, I'll take maybe two, three tops so we can get the other panel in. Right up front here.
Hi, my name is Allison. I'm the director of the company for Normal. I know probably you can answer that as part of this question and comment that I have, but at least I'd like everybody to hear it. I really didn't hear anybody touch on the Fourth Amendment violations that chronic pain patients are having to go through by state mandated drug toxicology screens if you are in pain management, which is a Fourth Amendment violation. I just want to make sure that everybody in the room is aware that even though the CDC changed their guidelines, this is still ongoing with pain management patients across the country. And secondly, do you plan on doing any regarding that type of situation? Because that's a whole segment of the population that I don't want to say they've been ignored, but I think that nobody's really paying attention to that type of problem. That literally, if you use any type of cannabis and THC shows up in a drug toxicology screen for your pain management, that you will be discharged as a patient from pain management. So therefore, we have a significant amount of the population that are actually being denied medical care because they use cannabis. And I know specifically, for example, at the Cleveland Clinic, someone was discharged from pain management grabbing 25 nanograms of THCA in their urine, where if they would have been a pilot or a truck driver, they would be out on the road and still be able to work due to federal guidelines. Yet if you're a pain management patient, you're not able to receive medical care. So I don't know if anybody can comment on that, or at least keep it in mind. And if you ever, want to maybe...
I'll just comment quickly on it. To the point that I think personal interest stories hold a lot of appeal to large audiences. They actually personally don't appeal to me, so I'm the wrong demographic for that. But I look and see what appeals to larger audiences. The idea of sort of the takeoff of CBD in Charlotte's Web, that was a story that was simply a number of anecdotes told, again, to large audiences. It was a personal slice-of-life story that pulled at people's heartstrings. People thought it was unjust, and it became a huge story, and politicians responded to it. So something like what you're talking about, which is certainly a phenomenon we're all aware of, that is something that can be spun as individual personal profile stories if the right outlet wants to cover it and if it's pitched in the proper way. So I do think there are opportunities to tell that story. And I think they'd make a difference if they're told in the right way. All the way in the back, and then I'll take one more question, and then we're going to wrap this panel up.
What's dead?
Hi, Kevin Mumology, National Outreach Coordinator of Normal. Love all the information. I just have a quick question and kind of a comment. In a lot of the articles that I see from mainstream media, some of the content may be very articulate, very well presented, but the caption or the photo that they include on these stories are of the typical stoner with a massive joint in a park somewhere. And so I know from posting on normal social media sites, 20 of the first comments are shaming the article because of the image that is being presented. But when you look at something like Leafly, they do a generic, maybe a marijuana plant, something that isn't so offensive to everyday marijuana consumers. Is there a way to change that?
Yes. We are in desperate need of stock photography around marijuana on all avenues of the issue. I mean, seriously, we look for those types of photos every day. There's actually a woman in L.A., I think she's in L.A., has an agency called Stockpot. It's a stock photography studio around cannabis. I think Drug Policy Alliance has put out a few things on their website along the same lines. And the more that we can do that, and also video, we need B-reel video desperately because more and more people are coming out video first. So that sort of thing is crucial. The dynamic that you're running into there is basically mainstream publications send out their photographers on one day of the year. They send them out on 420. And that's where it's basically going, like going out on Oktoberfest or St. Patrick's Day with alcohol, right? And you get the big old bong and or the joint, and that's hilarious, and it's a great visual. But that's not your typical cannabis consumer.
Yeah. You're on Shutterstock. weed.com, and there's just not that many options. I mean, if you think it's bad for weed, you should look at your options if you're on a just a stock photo service for heroin.
Oh, wow.
Or it's, I mean, that's really bad.
Thank you.
Okay, do I have time for one more?
Okay,
one more, and keep it a question, not a comment.
So recently the DEA released its findings and as well as report on a strong institution for natural research, the University of Mississippi. And what was found was that it was just outdated compared to Denver, Colorado's emerging cannabis scene. My question is, since you are better in media, where do you find your source? What is the voice of reason of academic integrity when it comes to the sources you use for your articles?
There's, it takes a while to find them and cultivate them. That's one of the reasons that one-shot articles are so bad. I mean, there's Donald Abrams, UC San Francisco, Greg Gerdeman down in Florida, Sue Sisley on PTSD issues. There are a number of people out there, but it takes some hunting to find them, and to get to know them well enough to trust them.
So what you're saying is there is no single voice that rises above the rest and says, this is...
No, I mean, often, honestly, Paul and Alan are really good sources to talk to first. Not necessarily to quote, because you can use up their quotes in a short period of time, but they're great connectors. They know who to connect you with, the experts out there in the field.
All right, thank you.